Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The death penalty and pot legalization faced legislative tests this week. We talk about how they fared with political reporter James Dawson. DSU professor Michael Gitcho is part of a team that just announced progress in their work to treat Alzheimer's disease.
I have a personal commitment to understanding this. My mother had Alzheimer's disease, and she lived with it for about 8 years before she passed about 10 or 12 years ago. So I'm very dedicated to trying to understand this disease.
We talked to Dr. Gitcho about his Alzheimer's research. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear how some UD students created storybooks to explain science to kids, and learn what President Trump's budget cuts could mean to the Chesapeake Bay in Chesapeake, a journalism collaborative. Plus, we have a new arts playlist and student work from our Generation Voice Youth Media Project. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Some of the bigger non-budget issues saw movement this week at Legislative Hall. The House signed off on reinstating the death penalty less than a year after Delaware's previous capital punishment law was ruled unconstitutional by the state's Supreme Court. And a bill that would fully legalize pot in the state cleared its first hurdle. And the bill to update Delaware's code to legalize abortion in line with Roe v. Wade also advanced through the state Senate. Our political reporter James Dawson was at Lake Hall for all of that and joins us again this week to help us dig a little bit deeper into these stories. James, thanks for being with us.
Hey, good to be here, Tom.
The bill to reinstate the death penalty made it through the House. That is not surprising, but did the votes line up pretty much as expected?
I would say for the most part, you had Representative Melanie George Smith, who sponsored the last two repeal efforts, but she voted this week to reinstate the death penalty. She didn't explain why she flipped her vote. And then as for another little change, Representative Andrea Bennett was absent during last year's repeal vote, but voted against re-implementing capital punishment.
Now, in terms of the arguments here, Representative Smith, his argument, as I read it, is that the changes being made to address the constitutionality issue also make it less likely someone would be wrongly executed under this new law. Am I correct in the way I'm reading that? And for those not following closely, what are these changes that he's talking about?
Yeah, that's his viewpoint. So the changes would require a jury to unanimously vote to trigger the death penalty. They've got to come to that decision beyond a reasonable doubt, and they have to find an aggravating factor. So keep in mind, the judge can overrule a jury's decision and impose a life in prison sentence instead. The reason why the most recent law was ruled unconstitutional was because a judge was the one who weighed these aggravating and mitigating factors, and those judges were also able to hand down a death sentence even if the jury voted for life in prison. And that's where the snag got, or where the snag was in the U.S. Supreme Court case.
Now this bill moves on to the Senate, which in the past has passed bills seeking to repeal the death penalty when it was legal. But as you've been saying all along, the dynamics have changed here in the Senate. Where is the most likely flip going to come from if we see one?
Yeah, you have two lawmakers who are getting targeted by both sides. So Senator Jack Walsh replaced repeal champion Karen Peterson this year. And in an interview with the Delaware State News in December, Walsh said that he would fight against any effort to bring back the death penalty. But then he told me this week that he's in a, quote, neutral zone in light of the killings of a state trooper and a prison guard. So basically, he's just saying, I'm not going to tell you how I'm voting. And then the other lawmaker is Senator Ernie Lopez. So he's a Republican that voted twice in the past to repeal. But people I've spoken with say they're really going to be leaning on him hard to switch his vote.
And so it is a situation that's going to bear close watching, particularly those particular votes. Let's move on to pot legalization, which officially began its legislative journey this week. First stop, a House committee, which pretty easily voted to release it to the floor for a full vote. Was the level of support from the committee members surprising in any way?
Kind of, sort of. So four sponsors of the bill sit on that specific committee, so it only needed another three votes to get to the floor. Also, the vote tally is a little bit deceiving if you look at it just strictly from a numbers standpoint. So Representatives Jeff Spiegelman and Stephanie Bolden both said that they're kind of apprehensive about the measure and may not actually vote for it when it gets to the floor. But they really wanted to see further debate, so that's why they voted it out of committee. Now, when I spoke with the bill's main sponsor, Representative Helene Keeley, she said that she was confident that it would pass in the House, but it's one of the most difficult types of bills to pass. They're going to need two-thirds of lawmakers in both chambers to sign off on it, and it's really hard to get that level of consensus on anything, let alone something this complicated or, in this case, new.
And that difficulty building consensus was probably pretty evident in the public comment where things were pretty split. Who's saying what on each side of this issue?
So they're all kind of familiar arguments that we've been hearing for years. Pro-pot advocates say marijuana is less harmful for you than alcohol and that it should be taxed and regulated as such. They're also saying it would bring tons of jobs into the state. And we're talking especially in rural areas where it would add to Delaware's already robust agricultural sector. They aren't really pushing the revenue side too much, even though it's estimated to bring about $22 million in its first year. And they're running into some of the most entrenched and powerful lobbying groups in Delaware. So, for example, hospitals and the healthcare industry in general, they're basically saying no one can prove there won't be any kind of health problems developing from this if more people smoke weed. They're especially concerned about kids getting their hands on it. And then you have AAA Mid-Atlantic saying it could lead to more people driving while high and more traffic accidents. Then also the State Chamber of Commerce says they want more protection for business owners. And that's despite the fact that in this bill you do have a provision that would still let employers drug test their employees and fire them if they don't want them to be consuming marijuana.
Very, very interesting. Unlike the death penalty, this is not going to go to the floor immediately. What's the timetable on this bill moving forward?
Right. So Representative Keeley said that she wouldn't run it before they recess this coming week. So that means that it's going to be until June, at least until we see it. So if the votes aren't there this year, she could also hold on to it until 2018 because we're in the first half of a General Assembly session.
I was going to say, even if it got to the House in June and passed, it doesn't seem very likely that it would get through the Senate and signed by Governor Carney by the end of this session. There's a pretty good chance this is going to get pushed to next year in one form or another.
Yeah, and Keeley's pretty, I don't want to say apprehensive about pushing this because she's not, but she's willing to slow down and make sure that she has the vote secured. And you just mentioned Governor Carney's signature. If they do pass it, it has this two-thirds bar to reach, right? It doesn't matter if Carney signs it. If he vetoes it, they can come back to the General Assembly, and they have the built-in two-thirds vote needed to override that.
That's a good point. Didn't think about that. And that's that makes it kind of unique in that way, that it would be kind of veto-proof inherently if it is able to get through both chambers.
And that's not even to say Carney also has the option of letting it become law without even signing it.
Leaving it on his desk. Absolutely. The abortion bill you brought up last week, officially updating Delaware's code to match what's been the law of the land since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Roe v. Wade. The intrigue, I guess, this week was in some of the efforts that were made to amend this bill before it got voted on. What were some of those amendments? What was that all about?
Well, the amendments would have restricted when pregnant women could get an abortion. So two of them would have outlawed abortions after around 20 weeks of pregnancy. And then another would have required girls younger than 18 to get parental consent before they get an abortion. Those were all defeated and not part of the bill. And just to be clear, these changes this changes nothing that already isn't happening in Delaware.
Right.
So doctors performing abortions here in the first state can determine whether a fetus can survive outside of the womb. And then they're also allowed to abort a fetus after it could survive if it's endangering the mother's health.
And late this week, James, we saw some movement on the state budgets. What did lawmakers unveil there?
Yeah, that's right. So leaders from all four caucuses signed on to a bill that would raise the corporate franchise tax. Now, only the biggest companies in the world that incorporate here in Delaware pay this tax, and no first state businesses would be included in this, according to state officials I talked to. So it would raise about $115 million. And really, it's one of the easiest tax votes that lawmakers have to take here. So it's a pretty safe bet that it was coming at some point. It was included in Governor Carney's proposed budget. And it's really been several years since they've raised it. So that's why they feel comfortable doing so now.
Is this an indication a full budget deal is now closer to happening, or that this is only the only thing that they could actually agree on and the rest may be a little bit more difficult to get done?
Probably about half and half. I mean, neither House Speaker Pete Schwarzkopf or Minority Leader Danny Short would tell me where they were on negotiations over things like personal income tax or any other subjects like that. But the thing that stood out to me was that they were both explicitly saying that talks were going well, which hasn't always been the case. Usually you hear Democrats saying things are going well and then Republicans will pull out from the negotiating table, at least in the past. But Short says that they need to finalize how they would spend any extra money that might come in from the final June revenue forecast before he's comfortable with a budget deal. And he would really want to prioritize things that are already in the budget, specifically aid to nonprofits, volunteer fire companies, and paramedics.
All right. James Dawson, thanks for being here again.
Thank you.
And remember, you can keep up with all of James Dawson's coverage of politics here in the First State online anytime at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We talked to a DSU professor about new research he and other scientists are doing into Alzheimer's disease treatment. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. A Delaware State University professor is part of a team of scientists that recently published research on Alzheimer's disease in the journal Neurobiology of Disease. Dr. Michael Gitcho and the team took a mouse with Alzheimer's and a protein that is found in most people with Alzheimer's and played with the levels of that protein in the mouse's brain to see how it affects memory and other brain changes. Delaware Public Media science reporter Katie Pikus sat down with Gitcho recently to learn more about this research.
Dr. Gitcho, for people who have an idea of Alzheimer's but don't know exactly what it is, what is it and what do we know of that causes it?
Well, the cause of Alzheimer's, age is the greatest risk factor. So as we age, but normal aging does happen. This is a disease where in the brain, we start to have memory loss at early signs of the disease. And then as this occurs, there's deterioration within the brain itself, and people die. And one in, I think, close to 5.5 million people in the United States are living with Alzheimer's right now. And Delaware is actually highly impacted by Alzheimer's disease because of the aged population. And since age is the greatest risk factor, it causes degeneration and requires care. I mean, it's been shown just recently through the Alzheimer's Association showed through a study that one in three people die of Alzheimer's disease in the aged population. So it's a very prevalent disease. There's a genetic risk factors and some other things that are very rare, but we understand a lot about the pathology and how the disease progresses. The pathology in the disease are composed of these plaques and tangles to where they're misaggregated proteins or they form these clumps of aggregates that cause the brain cells, the neurons in the brain to die. And when the neurons start to die is when we start to lose our memory and those changes occur. But why it starts when we're in our 60s and 70s years of age, at 60 or 70 years of age, that's one of the big questions that people are trying to look at.
When you say one in three people die of Alzheimer's, are we talking nationwide?
Yeah, nationwide. The Alzheimer's Alzheimer's has a FACTS study that came out, the 2017 FACTS came out this last month, and they're showing not only that, between worldwide, there's probably 30 million people with the disease, and it's a worldwide epidemic almost. I mean, it's fairly prevalent, and there's a lot of studies out in order to understand what this disease, what the impact of this disease has, or mechanisms leading to this disease too.
So tell me about your research and what you and your team did.
So we took a mouse that, it's an Alzheimer's disease mouse that develops plaques, and we wanted to look at another gene, this other protein, this TDP43, but it's this other protein. And this protein is present in about 50% of those with Alzheimer's disease. And it becomes an aggregate, like I said, with the other as the plaques and the tangles aggregate too. So with it being present in that many with Alzheimer's disease, we wanted to see if we can play with the level of this gene to where we turn it on or turn it up or down, and we can see what happens to those plaques and tangles in this mouse model.
And sorry, to go back for a second, you've said the word plaques a few times.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Plaques are these aggregates that accumulate on the outside. Outside of the brain cells, so they're extracellular. They're in the outside of the cells, and they form these almost protein clumps in the brain. And what happens is there's plaques, and the tangles are part of the inside of the cell that mess up the neurons themselves that form these tangles.
So what did you and your team of researchers do to test these questions that you had about the protein?
So when we turn on this gene, this TDP43 gene, when we turn that on, these mice do not develop tangles. They only develop plaques, and they've been engineered to just to develop plaques and to be able to study over the course of time. So what we did was we turned this gene on, and what we found was that when we turn this gene on at a very low level, we get a change in the plaque deposition, and we start to increase the tangle formation. So it's an early time point, and we're trying to look at it further and see if it affects memory or changes in that. But we think that what's happening is that when the plaques and tangles start to form, it turns on this gene to respond. And this gene responds to this to where it kind of accelerates the disease over time. So what happens is, what we think is going on is that as this TDP43 gene is turned on, we get a regulation of these plaques and tangles that may accelerate the disease. So this could be important as far as targeting this gene that would affect both pathologies in Alzheimer's. That's really what we're looking at.
And what have you guys found out so far?
Well, we found out a few things, that this gene regulates other proteins that are involved in this pathway of pathogenesis. So we think that we can, with this model, we're going to study memory and learning right now. So we're going to look and see how this affects memory. And the neat thing about the model is that we can turn this gene on and off by what we feed the mice. So we can turn the gene off when we feed them a certain diet, and then we can see what effect that has in memory. And we can turn it on and see. So we have some older mice that we're looking at. The mice from the study were about 9 months of age. Mice live around 2.5 to 3 years, and we have 24-month-old mice that we're looking at now. And I'm very excited. I don't know what the pathology is going to look like or if there's changes, but I'm excited to see what this gene is doing as they've aged, and especially with how it relates to memory. I have a personal commitment to understanding this. My mother had Alzheimer's disease, and it'd be nice to... she lived with it for about 8 years before she passed about 10 or 12 years ago. So I'm very dedicated to trying to understand this disease.
When we look at Alzheimer's disease and a lot of unanswered questions that there are out there about it, what is sort of the main problem that you and your team of researchers are trying to solve? Is it, you know, early detection for Alzheimer's? Or talk about sort of the main problem.
Well, the main problem that we're trying to find is to see if this gene could be a target for both pathologies. Right now, they can target one or the other, either the plaques or the tangles. But if this gene affects both, then maybe this will be a good target in order to slow the progression of this devastating disease.
And is it considered untreatable or uncurable now?
Yes, it is. There are medication out there that does help with memory to slow some of the progression, but the disease progresses, and there's no cure for this.
And anything else you want to add about the research or, you know, Alzheimer's in general?
I think it's important to really invest in the research for us to find a cure for not just Alzheimer's disease, but so many of the other diseases that are out there with cancer and cardiovascular and other things. And the best method we have is to really invest in developing, in the development through science in order to understand these terrible diseases.
Thanks to our Katie Pikus and DSU professor Dr. Michael Gitcho for their time this week discussing Alzheimer's disease and the latest research being done by Gitcho and his team into that disease. Stay with us. There is more to come on The Green, including the latest piece from Chesapeake, a journalism collaborative, looking at how President Trump's proposed budget cuts could affect the Bay watershed. But first, your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Much to the horror of environmentalists, President Donald Trump has proposed zeroing the EPA's Chesapeake Bay program out of the federal budget. Congress recently passed a spending measure that keeps the money flowing to it for now, but that's only good until September. With that in mind, Reporters for Chesapeake, a journalism collaborative, decided to see what zeroing out that funding would mean in practical terms for Bay cleanup. Joel McCord from WYPR in Baltimore starts us out with a look at stream restoration efforts.
Jesse Iliff is rocketing across the South River on a windy morning, headed for Beards Creek and one of 21 stations along the river to test for dissolved oxygen, pH and chlorophyll levels, and clarity, all those things that tell you about the health of the waterway. And for the most part, the river, once highly polluted with the runoff from suburban development south of Annapolis, has been getting better, if ever so slightly.
You know, you got to take into account the degradation of the Chesapeake and the South River has taken centuries, and it's going to take more than just a few years to pull it all back together.
Iliff, the South River keeper, says it's hard to pin down a single reason for the improvement, but one thing's for sure.
There's been the Chesapeake Bay TMDL has forced states to implement water quality improvement practices across the Bay watershed.
TMDL, that's total maximum daily load, the Bay's pollution diet. It was created by the EPA and Bay watershed states in 2010, imposed pollution limits, and set federal penalties for noncompliance. It's been credited with signs of improvement after decades of failed cleanup efforts. But if the Chesapeake Bay program shuts down, the pollution diet disappears, along with some $73 million worth of research, water monitoring efforts, and cleanup projects. Projects like this one, at the headwaters of Church Creek, once the most polluted South River tributary. It receives the runoff, loaded with oil, heavy metals, and road salt from the parking lots of three Annapolis area shopping centers. The water roars into the streams, carves the banks, and carries off sediment.
This is the downfall of suburban streams.
Nancy Merrill is the outreach coordinator for the South River Federation. She's describing a $1.6 million restoration project that took the mess created by that runoff
and transformed it into seven large step pools that work to filter and slow down that water so that by the time it gets through our restoration project, it has less dirt and nutrients in it.
That was 3 years ago, when they could only find five fish in the whole stream. They found nearly 400 in a recent survey.
Mostly minnows. There were some perch, there were some bluegill and sunfish, eels, a lot of mummy chogs and golden shiners.
Merrill says the project restored underwater grasses that help filter pollution and brought birds and a ton of deer back to the stream. But that's just one of some $12 million worth of similar projects in Maryland and $47 million worth throughout the six states in the Bay's watershed. That's according to Shante Coleman, director of the Choose Clean Water Coalition.
The projects would just go away. Nothing more happens unless, you know, somehow Maryland would magically be able to pull that money out somewhere, which I don't see happening.
Governor Larry Hogan's press office issued a statement saying he would fight for the Chesapeake Bay and work to address hypothetical cuts through the state budget process. Officials in other Bay states had similar reactions. Delaware Governor John Carney said in a statement he was frustrated with plans to eliminate the program that helps to protect vital and beautiful areas of our state. And Patrick McDonnell, acting Secretary of Pennsylvania's Department of Environmental Protection, fired off a letter to EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. He charged that proposed cuts in EPA funding signal the Trump administration's disregard for environmental concerns. For now, however, people like Jesse Iliff will be able to continue their work, at least until September. I'm Joel McCord for Chesapeake, a journalism collaborative.
Thanks, Joel. And a reminder that Chesapeake, a journalism collaborative, is funded by the participating stations with grant support from the Clayton Baker Trust, the Bancroft Foundation, Michael and Ann Hankin, the Jim and Patty Rouse Foundation, the Rob and Elizabeth Tyler Foundation, and the Midshore Community Foundation. Stay with us. The Green continues momentarily with a new arts playlist and a conversation with well-known Delaware photographer Kevin Fleming about his latest exhibit. This is Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware photographer Kevin Fleming has been all over the world with his camera. It's taken him to sheep ranches in New Zealand, the Arctic, and even to war in Somalia. But he's never been able to shake his sense of home. That's why these days he takes pictures of Delaware scenes. Fleming spoke to our Mark Earhart recently about his latest exhibit, Definitely Delaware, on display now at the Historic Houses of Odessa.
Kevin Fleming, thanks for joining us. For people who aren't familiar with your photography, could you describe your work?
Sure, Mark. I have been a photographer for a long time in Delaware. I started at the Delaware State News back in the 70s, then was at the News Journal for 5 years. Then I went to National Geographic and traveled around the world doing all kinds of things for them, from high-energy physics to the story of Ulysses in Homer's Odyssey. So I've photographed quite a number of things. I've been to 28 countries in all 50 states on assignment.
Wow, National Geographic, all those countries, all 50 states. What makes Delaware so special?
Well, Delaware's my home. You have to live somewhere. I've been to Tahiti. That's pretty nice, too. But, you know, my friends are here, and I'm a Delaware boy and proud of it and happy to be here.
Okay. What do you like to photograph here in the first state?
Well, I've done quite a few books. I think I'm up to number 27. I believe 6 of them have been about Delaware. Since I live at the beach, I've been photographing a lot of wildlife and nature. I did a book titled Wild Delaware, and that was successful, sold out. And then I did Wild Delmarva, so I could go a little wider and get the whole peninsula. And then I did a book titled The Beach, which is wildlife and nature and landscapes here in coastal Delaware. And that was a fun one to do because, you know, you have to show Delaware to people that live here in a different way. So you have to get out before sunrise, like I did this morning, and be shooting really good light and hopefully find good subjects.
So you were out just this morning taking pictures of the sunrise?
I was. I was in Cape Henlopen State Park. And generally speaking, I try to get somewhere about a half an hour before sunrise because that can be the best light of the day. And once the sun comes up, you might be done. Never shoot anything in the middle of the day.
So it's kind of beginning of the day, maybe even towards the end of the day, gives you the best light?
If it's clear, I would go out and look for wildlife and nature. And if there's some cool clouds in the sky, like there was this morning, I would go out and try to find a landscape where the clouds in the sky can be part of the scene. But a landscape photograph of blue sky is just generally boring.
The photographs that I'm drawn to definitely have sunrises, sunsets, or something different going on that makes me want to be at that particular place at that particular time.
Mm-hmm. It's being here on the East Coast, sunrises tend to be better because you can get photographed back into the light where all the color is.
Yeah, I never noticed that. Never thought about that.
Yeah, if I lived on Hawaii, I could shoot sunrise and sunset, just drive around the island. But here in the East Coast, it's definitely better at sunrise.
So tell us about your exhibit on display at the Historic Houses of Odessa.
I have maybe 30 photographs there. It's the building that's right across from Cantwell's Tavern, and it's in four or so different rooms there. And they're all Delaware photographs from all three counties, stuff I've worked on over the years, and it's a really nice show.
So in this show, you pulled photographs from all three counties. Are they mostly recent photographs, or did you have to go back a while to pull some of your favorites?
Many of them are from fairly recent, my book projects, and some go back a few years to maybe like 6 years ago.
About 6 years worth of photographs. Is there one that in particular is your favorite that really, really screams, this is one of my favorite things in Delaware?
Well, yeah, I think that I was interviewed for CBS Evening News, and they asked me, what's your favorite photograph? Do you have one that's a perfect photograph? And I had to stop and think about that for a minute. But it would be the three great egrets that's on the cover of my book, Wild Delaware. And they're in a dead tree in a rookery in the River Bay. And it's shot right back into an orange sunrise light. And it's pretty much like a perfect picture.
I'm actually looking at it right now, and I think it is a perfect picture. It's that red haze. Was that at sunset or was that at sunrise?
That was a sunrise. And that haze is your friend in the summer, because instead of having a blue sky and really bright sunrise, that haze makes the sun really warm. And you can shoot for more than a few minutes. Sometimes if it's a real hazy day, you can shoot for an hour or two. But usually I'm done right after sunrise. That was a good day.
So set the scene with these three egrets. Did you happen to just come upon them, or were you shooting that spot and they flew?
Oh, I shot, that's an island on Indian River Bay, and I've shot there many times. I think that tree is gone now. That island's had a lot of saltwater intrusion, and all the trees are dead and have gone away now. But it's still a rookery, and it's still a good place to photograph. You can, like that morning in particular, I photographed into the sun at sunrise and then took my boat around to the other side and photographed the great blue herons and great egrets frontlet. So it's a really good place to go for wildlife.
Yeah, that sounds like a great day.
Yeah, it's a good morning.
So after your historic Houses of Odessa show, what's up next for your photography here in the first state?
Well, I'm going to have a show at Fort Miles, which is in Cape Henlopen State Park. It's going to be my first show in a World War II bunker, kind of unusual place. But the museum there is shaping up quite nicely. And I'm going to have like 120 feet of walls to fill with stuff, so there'll be a lot of photography there. I think that show opens May 15th or so. Yeah, and your listeners are interested, they can find my photography at kevinfleming.com, and has a lot of Delaware and some international photographs there.
So you started out in print journalism and print photography, rather, at a couple papers here in the first state, and then you moved on to National Geographic. Do you ever get the itch to go globetrotting, jet-setting around the world?
Not so much anymore. I'm getting older, and not falling apart or anything, but I've traveled quite a bit, and it's something nice about being at home. So I was very fortunate to see a lot of the world, been around several times, and now I'm comfortable being here and happy photographing Delaware.
Really quickly, do you have any tips for people who maybe just want to get out and about town, getting out and about in Sussex, Newcastle, or Kent County, just wanting to take pictures on their own? What are a couple pieces of advice for us amateur photographers?
Well, photography is all about light. And like I said before, if you can photograph in good light, that's a great start. And then I try to put a verb in my photographs, and sometimes that can be something happening, like the great egrets we were talking about. Sometimes just the light can be the verb. So if you're going to go for good photographs, go near sunrise and sunset, and that's a great start. Try to find something interesting and figure out an interesting way to show it.
I like that. Put a verb in your photograph. That's great. That's great.
That's actually original.
Okay. Well, Kevin Fleming, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's good to be on.
And our thanks to our Mark Earhart and photographer Kevin Fleming for their time this week on The Green. Fleming's photo exhibit, Definitely Delaware, is on display at the Historic Houses of Odessa through July 16th. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, which has an education theme this week. Stick around for that. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. We have a double dose of Enlighten Me this week with a common theme of education. We start at the University of Delaware and an effort to take complicated science concepts, often difficult for anyone to understand, and communicate them to kids. UD tried a different approach to doing this by bringing science, art, and psychology students together in a new course. Their assignment, create storybooks aimed at clearly explaining scientific research on an invasive fish to children ages 3 to 6. Delaware Public Media Science reporter Katie Pikus recently visited the UD Morris Library to watch librarians read some of the books to their target audience.
four children crowd enthusiastically around University of Delaware librarian Lauren Wallace as she opens a book called Commotion in the Ocean.
Commotion in the Ocean.
Why is that commotion in the ocean?
We're going to find
commotion
out.
Commotion in ocean wide.
Let's see. Under the wide open seas by the algae trees, groupers live in their coral garden, where no fish ever felt barred in. The groupers swam and fed on little prey fish.
Minutes later, Wallace finishes the book, and she asks the children a couple of questions.
So what was the main problem in the story? So either there was not enough food for both the lionfish and the groupers, or the lionfish was mean to everyone else. Which one was it?
He was mean to everyone.
So raise your hand if you think it was there wasn't enough food for the lionfish and the groupers. Okay. And what about the lionfish was mean to everyone else?
The lionfish was mean to everyone else.
The book is the product of a course launched by University of Delaware professors this past semester called Science Through Storybooks. It married three subjects, science, art, and psychology, to create storybooks out of dense research on invasive fish called lionfish. One book was about how lionfish are unique predators. Another looked at how lionfish invade a nursery reef and cause it to have too much algae. UD marine scientist Danielle Dixon is one of the professors who taught the course.
It's really important when you do science that you are able to communicate it to the general public. That lets people know what you're doing and why it's important and why it affects them.
She's had a vested interest in communicating science through storybooks ever since she went to Fiji to study coral reefs. While there, she noticed some of the children were littering, so she wrote a book about a shark that ate a soda can and got a stomachache, and read it to them to help them understand how littering affects sea life. That sounds easy, but Dixon says simplifying science is actually pretty daunting, particularly when the audience is young children.
I think the real challenge is making sure that you keep the science, but have a background story that doesn't distract from the science. That can be much more difficult. And that's just trial and error, really.
Marine science major Taylor Tewksbury says explaining concepts to kids is a great place for scientists to start learning how to communicate about their research.
If you can explain it to someone who's like 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, then you can really know that you have mastered the information and you can really explain it to anybody.
Anybody, like 3-year-old Sam Grotti, who was at the reading last Thursday night.
What did you learn from the story?
I only learned one thing about lionfish.
Okay, what was it? What was it that you learned?
Because of their spines. They sting.
They sting?
Taking the books for a test spin is useful since this is the first time UD offered the course. Dixon says it seems like most children could follow the stories and, for the most part, correctly answer questions about the content. But any tweaks to the course will have to wait. It was built this semester using a nearly $11,000 grant. They don't have the funding to offer it again in the fall, but Dixon says they want to bring it back in the future, if money can be found. In the meantime, she'll share what she learned teaching the course with her UD colleagues this summer, hoping to help them discover ways to make communicating about their work child's play. Katie Pikus, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Katie, for enlightening us this week. Part two of this week's Enlighten Me takes us back to our Generation Voice Youth Media Project at Mount Pleasant High School in the Brandywine School District. We occasionally like to highlight the work students there are doing here on the green, and in this case, it's the work of a student stepping out of his comfort zone. A few months ago, Generation Voice students were tasked with finding a compelling story outside the school walls. One of them, sophomore Ayman Chowdhury, decided to approach a homeless man in Rodney Square. Here's what he produced from that conversation.
How many times have you passed by people sitting on the street with a plastic glass or a small cardboard box asking for a spare change? I'm Ayman, and on March 4th, I went up to one of those persons who we know as homeless and interviewed him. This is his story.
My name is William, a.k.a. Willie Mack, W-I-L-L-I-E-M-A-C-K, like the street. I'm 45.
How long you've been homeless for?
Let's see. This past July made it 7 years.
What's the best thing you ever got while being here?
Wow. I mean, I've gotten a $100 bill a handful of times over the course of this. Actually, a stranger, I don't know, It just pulled up to me, didn't know me from the Son of Sam. They had a piece of property that they bought. They invested all this money, in rehabbing it. And they gave me a place, they let me go and sleep there at night to make sure no one broke in. Now keep in mind, they didn't know me from the Son of Sam. They didn't know if I would be a risk to their project or whatever. So that's probably one of the coolest things that someone has done. And they to this day, can still barely, they have to ask me what my name is. And I stayed there for almost like a whole year. Yeah, so that was pretty weird. I ended up, in my last job, developing cancer. All right, my mother had just passed with lung cancer. I just took it out of a mortgage on a house. I had someone to handle my affairs while I was in treatment, and I came out, they ripped me off. They took everything. I had no job to come back to. I had to give a signing bonus back because the year that I got everything in was probational. And so, like, literally, I had nothing. I couch surfed for probably the first few months until that all ran out. I ran out of people whose couch I could sleep on. And then I started in abandoned buildings, and that didn't work out good. And I started sleeping on this corner. Fast forwarding to April 2011, I slept on this corner for basically almost a year and a half. Slept through summer, spring, summer, fall, and winter. Before I got the first house that offered to stay in the first house that someone was fixing up and rehabbing. So I've been kind of moving, bouncing back around. Sometimes I sleep over there on the bench over there. Sometimes I sleep on the other side of this bridge. But the thing that I want people to know most is that not everyone came out here for the same reason. Some people come out here and they've been out here so long that they do become mentally ill. Some get depressed and become alcoholics or drug addicts. I've now chosen, I'm not going back into the system. I look at myself now as being free from having to pay bills and having to slave to enrich other people. And I stay pigeonholed in a mediocre life. So I'm not going back to that now. That when I got sick, the system and everything didn't care about me anymore. I feel like I'm totally and completely free now. So I don't have the same stress that I used to have that probably contributed to making me sick in the first place. So that's pretty much it. You're a pretty cool kid for doing this. This is one of the coolest things that have happened to me in a long time. I've had many other people come out here. I mean, from Italy, from French Canadian television, to a guy who does documentaries for PBS. But no one who is just as independent as you are and as young as you are. I've got socks older than you.
Thanks to Mount Pleasant High School sophomore Ayman Chowdhury for that interview from our Generation Voice Youth Media Project. A reminder, Generation Voice is a partnership between Delaware Public Media, the Brandywine School District at Mount Pleasant High School, and its radio station, WMPH. And that's a wrap on The Green this week. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to the Greens page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast on our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Joel McCord from WYPR in Baltimore, reporting for Chesapeake, a journalism collaborative. Mount Pleasant High School sophomore Ayman Chowdhury from our Generation Voice Project at WMPH and the Brandywine School District. Delaware Public Media's Mark Earhart, James Dawson, and Katie Pikus, as well as our president and station manager, Casey House. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.